Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Kenneth Pitania. He is the Stevenson Professor of Biological Sciences at Vanderbilt University. We're talking about his book, Great Adaptations, Star-Nosed Moles, Electric Eels, and Others, Tales of Evolution's Mysteries Solved. Ken, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about Great Adaptations.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
You had me at Star-Nosed Mole. That's like, I have to say this, that's my hard luck animal for my entire life of 60 plus years.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm a natural historian. I mostly work with birds, but I have always wanted to, since I was a kid, have always wanted to see a star-nosed mole. And I found them, certainly, dead, but I've never seen one live.
Well, that's such an interesting parallel with my life in the sense that the first one that I ever saw was dead when I was a kid. And, you know, as I pointed out in the first chapter, that made an impression on me.
Yeah, it does. If you see one of these things and you don't know what you're looking at, it is the weirdest kind of thing. It looks like a mole that's eating two starfishes.
But let's start out, I
want to talk about the book in general. The great thing about this book is it's an account in chronological order of your scientific work and essentially how you became a scientist. And overall, the grand underlying story of this is how science works. And this is how science gets done. And I love that about this book.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you say that. You know, it was an adventure to write and sort of look back on all these different creatures that I've studied over the years.
Yeah, lucky you.
Yeah.
Now you work.
Myself really privileged.
Oh yeah, you've worked with some very charismatic animals, as we'll talk about in a bit. But I want to mention one of the coolest things about this book is that you use QR codes. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, you know, I have seen in my career so many incredible things that these animals do. And I early on took the habit of including videos in my scientific publications because I wanted people to see what was going on. And I just wanted to carry that over to the book because, you know, it's one thing for me to tell you that the star-nosed mole can eat things faster than any other mammal, or that an electric eel can leap out of the water. And, you know, that's great. But to see it happen is another thing entirely. So for those people that are interested in getting a closer look and seeing some of this stuff in action, that's included there. So that was fun to do.
And it's really easy. If people who don't have a QR reader on your phone, you can download the app incredibly easily, and you just hold the phone up to the book and wham, you're in a world of film, literally showing you what we're talking about. Now, let's talk about the star-nosed mole. It looks like a small, it's an insectivore, it's a mole, sort of a small mole. It looks like it's eating two parallel pink starfish. So you get this thing that looks like an octopus coming off the end of its nose. Now, what a lot of people are surprised about is not only like a regular mole, it burrows underneath the ground, but it's also fairly aquatic.
Yeah. And that is a bizarre aspect of its biology. And to this day, I'm still intrigued by that sort of somewhat unexplored side of its life because it will dive into streams and ponds for food. But the amazing thing is it seems to do that more often in the winter. And so this is an animal that doesn't hibernate. And it's an animal that lives up into the northeastern United States and way up into Canada. So it doesn't seem like a logical strategy to dive into the water in the wintertime.
Not at all.
And I guess the explanation is there is a huge amount of invertebrate prey there that's scattered along the bottom. So it's a rich source of food, and apparently it pays off for the mole.
Does it have an extra thick coat to withstand the chill of diving into winter water?
They do in the wintertime, and they actually shed their winter coat in the summertime. So they look different at different times of years.
Now, one of the first things confronting this animal is, what the hell is that star at the end of its nose?
Yeah.
What is it good for? And how did you start to get to work with them?
Yeah, I mean, that's the long-standing elephant in the room, so to speak. You know, what the heck is going on with that structure? And it had been a mystery, really, for, you know, many, many decades since it was first described. And I got interested in this and involved in this when I was an undergraduate, and I got a chance to volunteer at the National Zoo. And there was a study going on by the mammal curator there, and the question was, what was exactly what you said, what the heck is the star for? And the question and the idea that we were exploring was, could this be like a radar dish for detecting electric fields?
Yeah.
You know, which makes sense when you look at it, but it turned out not to be the case. And that was a classic story of what goes on in science, which is a lot of our best ideas sort of from the armchair turn out to not be true when you get down delving into the data.
And what kind of habitat are they found in? Because you had to go out and trap them.
Yeah, they live in wetlands, in moist, muddy soil. So they're actually amazingly fairly common in their habitat, even though we almost never see them. I kind of make the analogy like, well, when's the last time someone saw the mole that lives in their yard? They're pretty reclusive. And then layer on top of that, they're living in a mucky wetland with overgrown vegetation where a lot of, you know, there's no golf courses in the wetland, fortunately. so you're not going to see the tunnels. And then added to that, the wetland habitat is a remarkable habitat full of lots of other small mammals. And so even if you're there, the chances that the animal in the tunnel happens to be a star-nosed mole, you know, that's another layer of the mystery of trying to find them.
Now, you describe this work as a gift. Talk to me about what you mean by that.
Well, I guess I kind of think of Feynman's, you know, Richard Feynman, the famous physicist's discussion of, you know, just how wonderful it is to make discoveries, to see new things that people haven't seen before. And there's nothing like looking at these outlier species that, you know, will reveal like a set of dominoes falling over one discovery after another when you really get to looking closely at them. And so that's kind of what I mean by that. I almost feel like I've been traveling in a foreign land in metaphorically in terms of the science, and I want to come back and tell people about what's in this incredible place.
So the question is, does the star-nosed mole use electric fields to detect prey? And you had to design certain kinds of experiments, and you started using agar barriers, which you've actually used in other parts of the book, too. What is an agar barrier?
Yeah, so this is a basically sort of a seaweed derivative that you can make into what's sort of like jello. And it's something that was used by a fellow named Adrianus Calmin to experiment with sharks, and sharks can detect electric fields. And he kind of showed this by using these barriers to block out everything but the electric field, which will pass through this barrier. And the sharks would attack prey through the fields or electric, or through the agar, or they would attack fake electric fields or artificial electric fields. And so I sort of adopted that strategy in this sort of quest to understand star-nosed moles. It didn't really work out, but it turned out that experience was great for me later when I ended up studying electric eels, because I had all this experience trying to work out how to probe animal behavior related to electric fields, previously, and that turned out to be a useful skill.
Now, what are Elmer's organs? First of all, that sounds hilarious.
Yeah, Eimer's organs, actually. Eimer's organs. So
it's Eimer's.
Eimer's organs. They are these remarkable touch receptors that cover the star. So that sort of was a big clue to the mystery of the star. So one thing, you might ask right off, like, what is the star made of? And it's essentially an incredibly elaborate touch receptor that is covered with these microscopic domes called Eimer's organs that are probably the most sensitive touch receptor organs on the planet. And the star-nosed mole has about 25,000 of these. So you might think of them as sort of pixels in a really high-resolution camera. Yeah.
So there's 22 appendages on the star, 11 sort of surrounding each nostrils.
Yep.
And they're essentially, there's some incredible electron microscope shots. They're essentially made of Eimer's organs.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a beautiful structure to see in the microscopy. It's an amazing structure just to understand how many nerve fibers go into there. So just to sort of blow your mind on sensitivity. So the human hand has about 17,000 touch nerve fibers in it. And, you know, for us, the human hand is sort of touted as, well, why can we do all these amazing things with making tools and using computers? And it's part of that is our very sensitive touch organs and our fingertips. Stoner's moles have 100,000 nerve fibers, and the star is only about the size of one of your fingertips. So imagine five times the sensitivity of your whole hand concentrated into one fingertip, and you start to get an idea of what the mole can do with this thing.
So just to be clear for the benefit of the audience, so Eimer's organs do not detect electric fields. So the mole is doing sort of super touch?
Yeah, and, you know, that was a lesson in the sort of science adventure in that I sort of felt like, oh, it was a failure that we didn't find electroreception here. But it wasn't really, because it turned out that their sense of touch is phenomenal. Their star acts like an eye. And that might sound weird for me to say, but I mean that in the sense that one central part of it is super high resolution. And, you know, any of the listeners, if you were to just focus on one part of a scene and try to see what was on your peripheral vision, suddenly you realize that your eye is organized in the same way. You've got central high-resolution vision, and then things are more blurry on the sides. And the same is true for the mole star. It's got this central high-resolution area and then this lower-resolution side parts, and it's constantly shifting the star just the same way we shift our eyes. So that was a real sort of surprise to realize that, you know, here's a creature that is so completely different from us. You would think, you know, as you said, it looks like it's got sort of this octopus sticking out of the front of its face. And yet, this is one of those science lessons. It actually parallels something totally familiar to us that we are doing every moment of the day when we're awake.
Then you start
seeing this high resolution.
So you start also then researching the neocortex of the star nose mole. And there are these things called barrel fields. What are those?
Yeah. So in mice and rats, there are these. So this is one of the, you know, the big quests in neuroscience is often to try to understand the neocortex, because it's unique to mammals. It's what gives us our abilities. It's what's really expanded in humans. And scientists have been looking at mice and rats that have these circular visible units in the brain. Essentially, they have a visible map of their whiskers in their brain, and that's an amazing thing to see. And I wondered if a star-nosed mole might have the same kind of thing. And so when we did look at their brains, you can literally see a star in their neocortex in the anatomy. It's kind of like the map of the star is sort of like it's stamped into the brain for us to see. It would almost be like you could look at the human brain and see a hand in the human brain.
Right, yeah. there was a big gap, wasn't there, in the 11th division? And how did that look? And that looked weird on the brain. It was huge.
Yeah, and so this is, you know, that's sort of the wonderful way that science unfolds is actually the first thing that we saw was the map looked wrong, and it looked like why is it? So the central part of the star that is high resolution is actually very small, but in the brain map it's huge, and so we didn't know what this was about. You know, why would there be this mismatch in the brain map that was so dramatic? And it was then that we went and looked back at the behavior of the star-nosed mole and realized that that explanation was that it was used the way we use our eye. And we have the same thing going on in our cortex for our high-resolution vision. There's a part of our brain map that's super expanded for the high-resolution part. And so, again, another nice parallel about, you know, an animal you would think we had nothing in common with, their brain is organized in the same way for touch that our brain for vision is organized.
And it gets weirder still. And there's a wild photograph in your book of a star-nosed mole embryo, which looks insane. It looks like some creature from another world. So you were interested in the development from the embryo of how this star develops, and it's totally counterintuitive.
Yeah, it's one of those evolutionary stories where the weirdness of the structure and the development is sort of tips our hand that things were not optimally designed. So basically what happens, I mean, you would never guess how this thing could develop. I couldn't have guessed. So the star develops with the little appendages from the star sort of laid back on the side of the mole's face and are actually constructed sort of in place on the side of the mole's face. And then over time, they peel up and bend forward. It's a really crazy developmental sequence, and it begs the question of why would this be the case? And it turns out that the explanation is when you look at some other mole species that have sort of protostars, is that the star evolved from sensory sheets that were facing backwards on the mole's face. And in the course of evolution, these things bent up. And part of that evolutionary sequence is replayed in development. I think the analogy I would use is it's kind of like a flounder. A flounder develops in this insane, crazy way where one eye gets pulled over, you know, to the other side and the skull is totally mismatched. And you ask yourself, why would a flounder possibly develop that way? Well, because it evolved from a fish with the eye on the other side. So evolution does some messy things.
The great thing about this book is there's a lot of detours into you doing some very weird things in order to complete your research. And you ended up having to try to look for another species of mole called the coast mole out in the West Coast.
Yep.
Because it had some things that were analogous to...
Exactly.
So you had to essentially go to a golf course and collect coast moles?
Yeah, so, you know, I had this challenge. Like, I didn't have it was a busy time. I didn't have a lot of extra time for trying to complete this project. And I just thought to myself, well, gosh, how would I find a mole quickly? And you can just start to think, well, about the movie Caddyshack. You know, where could I go and basically enlist some people to help me? And I knew that a golf course would be the perfect place. So I just flew into Portland and went to Tillamook County and picked up the phone book and called the nearest golf course. And this crazy plan worked. Basically,
you found this woman named Judy.
Yes, yes. And she basically was in this constant battle, as most golf course owners in the area are, with the mole. And, you know, literally their solution was to use a shotgun to basically battle the moles, which amazed me because, you know, golfers, you might think that would be distracting. But
she was pretty intense. She was pretty intense about those moles.
Yeah. She was, and very efficient at it. And, you know, that's one of those things where I sort of say, I won't tell you all the details of how efficient she was, but I say in the book, and it's true, it's a really good thing. All I needed was a nose because, yeah, and it worked. I got the nose, and, you know, and usually when you say the smoke cleared, it's a metaphor, but in this case, it was sort of a dead-on reality. And,
wow,
you know, that mole in that area essentially solved a problem of the development. You know, why would the development be so unusual? And it turned out that I would call it the Archaeopteryx of moles because, you know, that's that famous bird.
Oh, yeah.
The transitional fossil. You know, in my little science world of moles, that was the transitional star case.
And it doesn't stop there with the moles, which is amazing. I think the thing that surprised me is how incredibly fast they are at catching their prey.
Yeah,
they're amazingly fast.
Yeah, they're you know. So I described, right, okay, so they're using this thing like an eye, moving the star around. And what happened was I wanted to quantify that, and I realized, well, I can't really see this very well in a normal video camera. So I bought one of these very fancy high-speed cameras, can film 1,000 frames in a second. And it didn't really dawn on me at the time what was going on. I was sort of focused in on the star movement, and then eventually I thought, wait a minute, I'm filming something that's happening almost too fast to believe. When I did the calculation and slowed down the video to see how fast it was moving, I literally couldn't believe that the mole was moving that fast. And I had to check the high-speed camera calibration to believe it. And it turns out that they are the fastest foraging mammals on the planet. So just to give an example, this animal can touch something, move to the central appendage to investigate it a little closer, decide what it is, eat it, and start to search for the next thing in a fifth of a second. That's about how long it takes us to blink an eye. So they are off the scale in terms of speed, and they're literally in the Guinness Book of World Records now based on that video.
And it gets weirder still, because when they're underwater, you start noticing that they were blowing bubbles.
Yeah. So then I thought, okay, well, they're incredibly efficient on land and incredibly fast. Are they slower? Does something, you know, what happens underwater? This seems like a challenge. So I just, without any real agenda, I just started filming them as they swam underwater and searched for food. And I noticed they were blowing out these bubbles and re-inhaling them. And that took a little while to think about as well, until I realized that this was essentially sniffing underwater. And then I put them to the test of going down scent trails underwater, which they can do. So that was thought to be completely impossible, and yet they can do it.
Yeah, I want to make sure we stay on this for a second, because what they were doing is they were exhaling and then re-inhaling the bubbles as they touched an object. So they're blowing the bubble off and then re-inhaling them to get the chemical information?
Exactly. And now you know why I put QR codes in the book, right?
God.
You know, for us to describe this, it's kind of like, that sounds crazy. Well, you got to see the movie, too. You know, they are doing something that people thought was impossible, and logically so. I mean, if you asked me before I looked at A Star Knows More, I wouldn't have said, oh, yeah, an animal could do this. You have to see it to believe it. And then you realize, well, you know, nature finds a way, as they say. Basically, they have evolved a way to use olfaction underwater. And it's remarkable. And the amazing thing about it is other animals can do this too. So we discovered this in the star-nosed mole. But since then, we found out the water shrew can do it as well.
Yep.
And some investigators in the Soviet Union have found that the Russian desmond can do it. So I bet lots of semi-aquatic small mammals can do it. So I just love that path of discovery.
Oh, my God.
You know, discovering a commonality in the weirdest nosed creature probably on the planet, but it turns out it's not because of its weird nose. You know, just science takes such unusual paths. It's just, as you say, a gift.
But by the way, this is only one section of the book. Throughout this book, it's you making one discovery after another of some very unusual things, like worm grunting and how it works. The fact that worm grunting exists and there's like a national holiday or week for worm grunting is amazing. But you found out how that exists. You got to work with water shrews. You got to work with tentacled snakes, which are wild. And then you worked with electric eels. Now, we're not going to have enough time to do all this justice, but you started finding that they did a sort of active electroreception. They were able to do this thing where they were able to control the fish's sort of nervous system via electricity.
Yeah.
Ah!
You know, it's incredible. I mean, literally, I spent a lot of time with those animals, and you would think I would be used to sort of what they do, but I am still blown away. I mean, I would joke with my wife, like, I can't even remember all the amazing things that you know, fell out of those studies when I try to list them all. So just to give one example, as you said, people wondered, or maybe I should say people didn't wonder about their electricity for centuries. They just thought, well, they shock things, and that's all we need to know. Well, it turns out they use pulses of electricity to activate the nerves in nearby animals in the same way that a taser functions. And so they're essentially sort of using their electricity to almost play the muscles like a musical instrument in another animal. And by having that ability, they can totally freeze up prey, so the prey can't move, just like a taser. And that's pretty straightforward. But the amazing thing is when they're searching for hidden prey, they can give off little blips of high voltage that makes the prey move, and that reveals the hidden prey's location. I mean, it's the most sinister and cool sort of predatory trick you can imagine. And that's just scratching the surface of what they can do.
Well, the interesting thing is you started the book up with this thing that, Alexander von Humboldt reported, where he decided to, first of all, this is bizarre. He decided to try to look for electric eels by sending a herd of horses into the water and having the eels come after them, and then the horses were shocked and they got the eels. And over years, over time, people have really doubted that story. But you find out it's actually totally possible.
Yeah, it's not only possible, I'm sure it happened. And the funny thing about that is I'm one of the doubters. So, you know, but it's not like there was a bunch of scientists that were trying to figure out, we have to go figure out if Humboldt was right. It was just this weird story from the past that everybody who talked about eels loved to retell, including me. But I thought, do I believe this thing? Well,
they do. They're aggressive. Yeah. They're not just using electricity for finding food. They can be aggressive.
Absolutely. And it makes perfect sense in retrospect, based on the physics of electricity. So imagine that you're a predator and you're harassing an electric eel. Well, most of that electricity is dispersed in the water if you're sort of on the shore reaching in. You don't get shocked very much.
Yeah.
And the answer for the eel is to essentially leap out of the water and push itself against you so it can maximally deliver its high voltage to you. It works well.
And you'll have to pick up the book to find out why he knows that. And there's some great film about that, too. My guest tonight is Kenneth Catania. He is the Stevenson Professor of Biological Sciences at Vanderbilt University. We're talking about his book. It is a great, interesting, fascinating, and fun read. Great Adaptations: Star-Nosed Moles, Electric Eels, and Other Tales of Evolution's Mysteries Solved. He's having a good time as a scientist, is what it is, and finding out some very wild stuff. Ken, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.